This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
G'day, Gladys and Potties. It's time for Friday night's Classic LNL, where we bring you some of the more intriguing bits from the archives. Tonight it's a program from 1993 that won a major human rights award. It's a fascinating and very passionate debate about deaf culture, an example of that decade's reassessment of what disability is, with members of the deaf community arguing that deafness is simply a different way of being and not a disadvantage. But first, be upstanding for Johann Sebastian Bach. And Johann Sebastian Bach and Philip Adams welcome you to another LNL coming to you across Australia through the 200 station Radio National Network. And tonight a program fraught with possibilities and difficulties, because tonight we are dealing with deafness as culture. And sitting around me are a number of people who are deaf persons. And we'll also be talking to a very fine writer called Harlan Lane in Seattle, who'll help us block out the central proposition. But let me get into it in my own way. In 1980, I spent an extraordinary year working for the state governments and federal government, the International Year of the Disabled Person. I entered that year with a whole lot of conventional attitudes to what disability was, and I learnt a huge amount. By the end of the year, I was a reformed character, with my prejudices and preconceptions shattered. But I did come out of that year with a strong impression that to be deaf was to be, perhaps, a member of the most alienated of the people who are grouped together under the term of disabled. Now I learn that this is a misread, that I was wrong to take that view, because it turns out, or it will be argued passionately today by Harlan Lane and others, that deafness is a discrete, rich and triumphant culture that is so powerful that it really doesn't need medical intervention. In other words, if it's not broke, don't fix it. You're going to be hearing people argue, not everyone will argue this incidentally, but some will be arguing that to be deaf is a good thing. There are deaf parents who cheer with joy when they discover that their child is deaf. So rather than feeling disadvantaged by deafness, they feel passionately proud of it and advantaged by it. So we're dealing with fascinating ideas that are really without cultural precedent for the able-bodied or those with a full complement of faculty. So that's what we want to explore today, is have we been looking at deafness in a totally inappropriate way? Now, joining us on the line from Seattle, Washington, is Professor Harlan Lane. Harlan's a linguist at Northeastern University who has studied and written on the history of the deaf and deaf culture. Harlan is a hearing person who also signs fluently in American Sign Language, ASL. And he's been described as the chief theoretician of deaf culture. Welcome to the program, Harlan.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, I know that we're going to lose you shortly, that you have to go off and make a major speech at a conference. So I'm going to start with you instead of bringing you in later. And I want you to block out the politics and the central assumptions of the notion of deafness as a triumphant, unapologetic culture. And then we will work around that later.
Well, I start with a fundamental distinction, which is between big D deaf and little D deaf. That is, there are many Americans, as Australians, who audiologically are deaf or hearing impaired, but who do not belong to the deaf community, who do not use sign language every day of their lives, who do not see themselves as culturally deaf people. For the latter group, increasingly we use the capital D just to signal that there really are many kinds of deaf people, but fundamentally two kinds: hearing people who have a hearing impairment, and culturally deaf people who as they put it, don't have a hearing loss because they never had hearing in the first place. It's not a matter of loss for them. It's a matter of being simply different than a great many Americans.
Mm. And as other writers, apart from yourself, Oliver Sacks comes to mind, has pointed out, sign language can be, in fact is, not can be, is, as rich a method of communication, as rich a mode of language as any verbal language.
Yes, deaf people have been saying for a very long time, ever since the first book published by a deaf person during the French Enlightenment, that they have their own community, their own language, that their language is sufficient to discuss all matters of the world and of religion. And it's only, though, in the last few decades that scholars have provided incontrovertible evidence of that for that claim. They have found that American Sign Language, for example, and also Australian Sign Language, to name an unrelated sign language, are powerful, rich, natural languages with unrelated to spoken language, with art forms of their own. There is a deaf literature and a deaf culture. And children who grow up deaf become acculturated to deaf culture and do not see themselves as disabled and in the terms of their culture are not disabled.
Harlan, to those of us who've got some mileage on the clock, there is a great familiarity with the rhetoric of capital deaf culture and the civil rights movement. There's the same sort of language is used, the same sort of defiance. Black was beautiful, deaf is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But there's also, I must say, to a layperson, reading the literature, reading what you've written and others, it gets so angry that I'm surprised or shocked to read or to learn that the thought of technological intervention or medical intervention is seen as almost rape.
Well, you shouldn't be shocked. We are... hearing people have been perpetrating for a very long time some really terrible practices that have cost deaf people very dearly in dignity, in effective education, in civil rights. And the history of the relations between hearing and deaf people right down to the present is a very sad tale. It's one in which hearing people take the posture of benefactors of deaf people. Hearing professionals know best. Deaf people have been deaf all their lives and live deafness every day do not have an opinion that weighs in heavily. And to cite one recent example of particularly blatant paternalism toward the deaf, the American Food and Drug Administration approved the surgical implantation of electronic devices in young deaf children without ever hearing from a deaf person. They had a panel of experts, and they had another 50 people who spoke to them, and not one of those people was deaf. Indeed, not one of those people was a hearing person who was knowledgeable about what it means to grow up deaf. So the very costly and very arrogant attitude of hearing professionals toward deaf people continues to this day. How can you not be angry about that?
We'll be talking to on the cochlear issue a little later in the program, so let's stick on the political similarities with the civil rights movement. Are you there, Harlan? I think we've lost Harlan momentarily. We have. Okay, well, while we sort that out, let me explain how the program is going to be structured. I'll be introducing you soon to a number of other participants and panellists. Carolee Aquiline is the manager of the Australian Association of the Deaf National Advocacy Service, a strong advocate for deaf culture, capital D deaf culture. Carolee was born in the US but has lived in Australia for many years. Now, she uses ASL and Aussian, is that how one pronounces it? Aussian? The Australian...
Auslan.
I can't even read. An Auslan. And can also speak English and read lips. But during this interview, Carolee has chosen to speak through an interpreter, the marvellously talented Paula Weber, who is sitting on my right. And Paula will, in fact, speak for Carolee. Might I ask through you, Paula, why Carolee has made this decision?
Well, I think it was good to give just another sort of view, because I know the other participants have decided to speak. So I wanted to sign in my language to show that I can respond on the same level as a person who speaks can.
Now, understand, listener, that the fingers were flying over there as Carol Lee signed to Paula, but the voice you hear is Paula's. Now, you'll also be meeting Sophia Golan. Now, Sophia's a NIDA graduate. She tells me she's been out of NIDA now. That's the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, if you're not familiar with the acronym. She's been out of NIDA for a year and is now working as an actor. Sophia learnt English first, but also speaks Auslan, but she moves in both the hearing and the deaf cultures. Now, Sophia will be speaking in her own voice, so it might be an idea to identify yourself vocally, Sophia.
Hello, this is Sophia.
Now, you're also quite fluent, are you not, in signing?
Yes, I'm speaking for myself today because sign language is not my first language. English is, and I'm more conversant using English because it's very hard to speak two languages at the same time because they're both very different structurally.
Well, I can ask you a question now because you belong to two worlds. You live in two cultures. Do you accept what Harlan says, that signing is a discrete language which has its own richness, its own character, its own strengths as a mode of communication?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've known sign language now for nearly 7, 8 years. I started learning when I was 17, when I first started working with Theatre of the Deaf, theatre company made up of deaf actors and directors. Prior to that, I had no knowledge whatsoever of deaf culture or sign language or what it meant to have good self-esteem about being deaf. Prior to that, I had always viewed my deafness as something of a hardship or perhaps some would say a disability. But now, it's not like that at all. It's just something that is there. And I do participate in the deaf community a great deal. I see deaf people and all those kinds of things. And sign language is very varied, very rich. It is a language that I prefer using most of the time.
Do you find there are feelings or ideas that you can express in sign language that are unavailable to you in English?
Well, I am a visually orientated person, obviously, because I am deaf. I have no auditory memory or auditory skill. And for me, sign language is visual. It comes through my eyes and it touches something in my heart because I am deaf and that is a visual language. But I also appreciate English too because I read and I write and I speak and English is a terrific language as well. But because I am deaf, sign language is the language.
Well, you're very lucky. You're bilingual and I'm stuck in one language mode here and I'm feeling very inadequate. Let me now introduce, we've got Harlan, that's good, we'll go back to Harlan in a second. Let me now introduce Samantha Green. Samantha is a jeweller who is severely deaf, a 75 decibel loss since born, which is middle range. But she went to the Shepherd Centre at 3 for 2 years and then to an ordinary hearing school. She graduated from Tech College after 2 years studying jewellery and she's now a jeweller. She uses various technical aids to interact in the hearing world and does not use sign language. So, welcome, Samantha.
Hello.
Are you familiar with these political arguments you're starting to hear about deaf culture?
Unfortunately, I don't listen every day about the deaf culture. I don't know why. It's the way I've been brought up. I've been totally moved away from the deaf culture system. I've come from a hearing family with hearing brothers and sisters, so naturally they brought me up in a hearing world, and you can't really compare because everybody's got different hearing levels, so it's just the way.
Well, I could see your face was very interested. You were fascinated to hear these declarations,
yes,
weren't
I
you?
Am.
You find them exciting ideas.
It is very exciting.
Yeah. Let me put this to you. With what you now know, if you were, you're going to marry soon, if your child was to be deaf,
yes,
would you want technical intervention to bring that child into the hearing world? Or would you now consider the proposition that deafness is its own culture and should not be treated as a disability?
If I had a deaf child, I would really think about doing as much possibility in a hearing world. And if my child grows up and doesn't like this, she can always go back and sign language and... if you know what I mean.
Well, I'm not sure that Harlan would agree. Now, Harlan, as I understand it, many people who are capital D deaf believe that that any technological move towards the hearing world destroys the integrity of the deaf culture?
Well, I think it's important to understand that we're not in a position to touch deaf children with a magic wand and make them hearing.
Yeah.
If we were, then the question you're asking is a very good question. Is there an ethical dilemma if you have that power? But I want to be very clear that we're not even remotely within reach of that. Over the centuries, we've often been misled by educators and others who presented a deaf child who could speak well, like Samantha Green, and said, you see, I have accomplished this. They don't give the credit to the deaf person, and I can do this with any deaf child. And there's still people who talk like that today. And there's a little bit of that misleading extrapolation for all deaf children from a few special cases in the matter of cochlear implants. There are a few late deafened children. They're in the minority. About 7% of all deaf children are late deafened. And among those, there are a few who have really remarkably benefited from the cochlear implant and are able again to understand English. But for the vast majority of deaf children who never learned English in the first place, because they were deaf before they could master it, the implants give them very little language benefit. So it seems to me doubly ill-advised, even though Australia is the world's leader in this and should be admired for the wonderful work in prosthesis for hearing people. But the device really is not appropriate for deaf people.
This is a good chance for me to introduce an old friend and sparring partner in Dr. Bruce Shepherd. Bruce is best known to the listener as an orthopaedic surgeon and the former head of the AMA. In fact, clearly, Bruce, its most notorious head in its long history. Now, Bruce and his late wife, Annette, learned in the early 60s that their two children were profoundly deaf. So he and Annette founded the Shepherd Centre for Deaf Children, which Samantha attended, and Bruce joins us now from Canberra. Bruce, were you aware, and as you approach this problem, of the ethical dilemma that that Harlan's outlining?
Philip, thank you for introducing me. I guess not. I was suddenly confronted with my wife one day when she found me playing with an alarm clock around my daughter Penny when she was about 6 months old. And it took us a long while to convince people there was something wrong, and it took a long while to get a diagnosis. But we eventually found that she was profoundly deaf. And we had one thing in mind, that was to give her optimum opportunity to communicate. And we went around the world, we looked at a lot of deaf schools, and we saw in those days people who were profoundly deaf were mainly locked up with other deaf children in schools. There are all sorts of standards, from fingerspelling through to some schools achieving quite good standards of communication. But especially we wanted our children to develop language, because it's not well known that the average profoundly deaf person who signs generally doesn't develop terribly good language, and they often can't understand a great deal of what they read, and they can't be made to make other people understand what they're thinking.
Yes, I wasn't aware of that until I was reading the literature in the last couple of days, that profound deafness does lead to great difficulties in writing and reading. In other words, another form of what used to be described as dumbness. But now that we know a little more, Bruce, that in fact the deaf culture is such a rich culture, would you feel as alarmed by the prospect of raising deaf children?
I probably was always alarmed. And I still feel that my two children, who have virtually nothing to do with the deaf culture, have optimized their potential. And they think so too. And I don't believe it's what we did. I think it's what we did with our children. And that my son doesn't talk nearly as well as my daughter. When we were in the Shepherd Centre, when we were first introduced to the cochlear implant, I was against it. My experience with implants in other specialties worried me about it, and it took me quite a long time to come around to believing that it was a worthwhile thing. I think, as at Harland, was what he said may have been right a few years ago, but now we're seeing deaf infants having a cochlear implant and sort of developing miraculously good language and miraculously good understanding. I firmly believe that my two children, whose greatest disability now is that they can't use a telephone, would have a cochlear implant if they were at the right age group for it, and they would be using a telephone.
Harlan, I have great difficulties with religion being foisted on children. I think it's a great shame that no one's taught any religion until they're of an age to make their own choice. But parents have a habit of deciding what their children are going to do, what they're going to believe, how they're going to dress, what they're going to eat. In your view, who has the right to make the decision about technical intervention in deafness? Are you there, Harlan?
Yes, I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can now.
Okay.
I'm asking you, who has the right, or who should be the person or persons who makes the decision about technical intervention in deafness?
Yes, I think that the parents have the legal right, and if they're properly informed and counseled, then I think they would have the moral right as well. I believe the decision should be made by the parents in conjunction with deaf people. Deaf leaders, professionally trained, ideally, who can examine all the different aspects of this with the parents. Even deaf people who've been raised orally, as I gather Dr. Shepherd's children have, very commonly in the United States, wish that they had learned sign language and set out to learn it as adults, because living as an oral deaf person is an extremely difficult thing to do. And there comes a time when many such people just want to relax and sign naturally and comfortably without the very taxing task of trying to lip read other people. So I think the thing to do is to talk it over with deaf people who've been deaf all their lives and know what deafness is about. And I must say I respectfully disagree with Dr. Shepherd. All of the published research makes it very clear that implanted children will be, as the professionals say, severely hearing impaired adults. And as such, I think it's likely that they're going to want to learn sign language and want to move into the deaf community. So it's terribly important to involve deaf people who know what that's all about in the decision-making.
You're with Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, listening to a program on deaf culture, originally broadcast in 1993. The guests include members of the deaf community, Carol Lee Aquiline from the Australian Association of the Deaf, speaking through the voice of interpreter Paula Weber, the actor Sophia Gollan, and the jeweller Samantha Green. You're also hearing Professor Harlan Lane, a linguist at Northeastern University, and Dr. Bruce Shepherd, founder of the Shepherd Centre for Deaf Children in Canberra.
The thing I learnt in the International Year of the Disabled Person was that it was all about choice. Some people wanted to be in the wider world, others wanted to stay at least partially in institutions. They wanted the choice. Carol Lee, let us imagine that down the track there is no technological argument that a device is invented which is miraculous, which does in fact make it possible for a deaf person to hear. What would your view then be if there was no technological downside? How would you feel about it?
Well, I'd actually still say that I'd want to stay as a deaf person. By that I mean that the last few minutes we've brought up a few different issues, and these are issues of communication and optimising my potential for communication, the issue of self-esteem, my self-identity, and there's also the issue of giving a person choices, and all three of those issues are things that people don't see or see from one side. For example, when we talk about optimising communication and the use of language, my big problem with that is, how do you define language? When Dr. Shepherd and Samantha say language, they mean English. Sign language is every bit as rich and as grammatically wonderful and expressive, sometimes even more so than English language is. So people would say that I've my choice to sign today and speak through an interpreter, I may be reducing my language. That's not true. I can
not
speak.
Not if they can see you, Carol Lee.
Precisely.
I mean, there's a floor show going on here, folks, which is dazzling.
Yeah, I'm showing you that I can communicate
but
on Carol an equal
Lee,
level
got,
and possibly
but Carol
even
Lee,
better.
You've got an extraordinary personality. No matter what sort of person you are in terms of, you know,
yeah,
you are voluble, you're energetic, you're funny, you're...
yeah, but when you talk about optimising potential, for me, it's the ability to have both, to have English and sign language, that's the optimal situation. I can fit into whatever situation I wish. If I only have English and no sign, that's not optimising my potential. I have choices. I can join in on both in both arenas. I mean, we talk about things like cochlear implant. I mean, we have to say, people say to that person, there's something wrong with you. You have to be fixed up. There's nothing wrong with me. You've already said that I'm voluble, expressive, and I've got a wonderful personality. So what in the hell's wrong with me?
Shutting you up's the problem. Can someone someone throw a bag over?
I'm very passionate. You use the word yourself.
You're deafening in your silences there, I must say. That's okay, look, I want to go back to Bruce. Bruce, these are new notions to me, I've got to say. You know, I
missed a little bit just then, but
But you understand the spirit of what Harlan's saying.
What a beautiful speech that I was just listening to. And we're not saying that a lot of our children from the Shepherd Centre, we've been going for 22 years now, have learned to speak, and some of them have married other deaf people who are signing people, and they sign themselves. And I agree with Carolyn that you need both. A lot of them need both. Hmm. And we don't... But we know that unless we start very early...
Why don't you give sign language as an option in the Shepherd Centre? Why aren't both practised?
Well, the Shepherd Centre goes from 0 till 5, and we believe that in those early years, unless we really develop language, that we're not going to get the children to speak at all, and they'll simply be able to sign.
Language. See, we come back to language.
Now, I want to go back to Harlan, because we're going to lose Harlan Lane in Seattle very shortly. Harlan, I go back to the parallels between deaf culture arguments and the civil rights movement, most of which I think are splendid and I would endorse. Mm-hmm. However, one senses that this could become a political correctness debate, that this could become an exclusionary device rather than an inclusive position. Now, do you feel that there's a downside, a danger, in what is increasingly a sort of a militant deaf position, that it may lead to a sort of a balkanisation of the movement, or worse, to a new form of ghettoing?
No, I don't, to be honest with you. I don't see in my deaf friends and in the deaf leadership in the United States, in any event, any desire to seal off the community in some way or to exclude hearing people. I think that deaf people believe correctly in the light of psychological and linguistic evidence that the best way to achieve the integration of deaf people into society is to educate them well and to educate them to be bilingual. And the best way to accomplish that is to use American Sign Language and to use the language to teach them English and to teach them about the world and to teach them a profession.
So empowerment first, and then they can negotiate with the wider world on a more equal basis.
Yes, I mean, I think the view that in some way deaf culture and deaf language are hostile to real participation in the larger society is very mistaken, and I believe that as close to zero as possible, it's very important to endow the deaf child with a full language. For most deaf children, that can only be the national sign language. And if you do that, and if the child meets other deaf people and develops a deaf identity and cultural awareness, then that child is a healthy, strong, and fluent child who will do well later in life and perhaps become a deaf professional and be a full participant in society. So the shortest distance between two points is not always a straight line. Mm. In this case, it has to go by way of deaf language and culture.
Samantha, when you came into the studio before and you introduced yourself to Sophia, it was interesting to watch the two of you negotiate.
Yes.
Because you have, in fact, been aided and assisted to become a hearing, speaking person. And you mentioned that you have very little contact with the deaf community.
Yes, I do.
You said that wistfully.
Did I?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
In other words, do you feel to any extent that while you've been, the door has been opened to the world of hearing and speaking, that another door has been effectively closed?
Well, can you explain that more specific? What?
Do you feel in any way excluded from a deaf culture that intrigues you and that you'd like to be a part of?
I don't really think about it that much. I do listen and read the newspaper, watch everything about the deaf culture, but I don't think I have the need for that ability because I'm happy the way I am. Mm.
Well, let me go to Sophia. Sophia, do you think that Samantha has, with the best of intentions perhaps, but in some way been robbed of another quite profound cultural experience?
Well, I think my experience as a speaking deaf person in a larger hearing world is one of immense work. I find that I have to work extremely hard to maintain relationships with all my hearing friends and with my family. And most often the case is they don't have to do as much work as I do to communicate. And while I don't mind doing that, because that's how I've been brought up. I've been brought up all, and my family speak very clearly, all that happened. But when I'm with my deaf friend, there is a richness of interaction and warmth that sometimes that I'm excluded from when I'm with, say, a group of hearing friends. And that's not to say that my hearing friends they wish to exclude me. Often they make a greater effort to include me, and I have wonderful times with my hearing friend. But there is a different quality to being with my deaf friend, which is almost like finding a home, so to speak. These people are like myself, and
but there's no home.
I have a good time.
What home are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about a cultural identity. I'm talking about a viewpoint, a way of thinking that deafness is not a hardship and not a problem. When I'm with my hearing friends, I'm always very conscious of them clocking over in their head, I have to speak a little more clearly, I have to make sure I'm facing my deaf friend so that she can be part of it. But with my deaf friend, there's nothing like that whatsoever. It's much more robust, much more straightforward.
Mm.
Do you feel
hang on, gang. We're going to be around for a while, but we're losing some of our other guests. So, first of all, are you still there, Harlan?
Yes, I'm very much with you.
Okay,
I'm very touched by the wonderful people in your studio.
Well, look, yes, I'm having a marvellous evening as well, but I know you've got to go, Harlan. I'd like you to make a final editorial statement before I introduce a couple of other voices to the program. You know, listening to the debate today, I take it your position is, God help us, is pro-choice, to borrow a language from another war that's being fought, isn't it? You really want people to have the right to choose.
Yes, I want hearing people to let deaf people be deaf. I believe it's a perfectly legitimate way to be. I think that we would condemn white parents who adopted a black child and then decided to have surgery done on the child to make that child pass more easily in a white world.
Yes, the Michael Jackson option is not one that many would want to exercise.
Yes, I think not. And, you know, Michael has still preserved a lot of his blackness. If we had the technological prowess to make a black child white, I mean, should we really be doing that? Now, Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, the American news feature program, said to me, Ed's black, and he said, it isn't like that. Well, to hearing people, it isn't like that, but when you really ponder the point of view of deaf people, when you ponder their history, which is available to Australians in my book, When the Mind Hears, A History of the Deaf, you come to realize that, well, from their point of view, it is like that. It is their culture, their dignity, their language, and it really is wrong to try and use technology to change it.
Now, Harlan, I thank you for your contribution. I'll let you go now and make a great speech. And I'm about to introduce another player. But first of all, let me put this to all of you. That, okay, we who can hear are probably deaf to a wonderful world of cultural experience. But conversely, there's more to hearing than, I have to say, using the English language. There's music, there's sound, there's a, you know, well, there's everything. And I still feel that if I were deaf, if I'd always been deaf, my curiosity about what was available to the hearing person would impel me to choose to ring up Professor Graham Clark, who's our next guest. Now, Graham is the director of the Bionic Ear and Hearing Research Institute. He's working on these extraordinary implant devices, which have been severely criticised today, and in some of the material I've been reading from the States. Graham, as you listen to this debate unfolding, and I'm not just mean today on this radio program, but as you've listened to the debate unfolding, have you been in any sense in two minds about the legitimacy of your work?
It's Philip, is it?
Yes, it is.
Firstly, I'm sorry I couldn't hear any of the debate there, so I think...
Well, you're suffering from hearing impairment. Let me say, the central proposition of the deaf pride movement, if you like, is that deafness isn't an illness, so don't fix it. Leave it alone. Don't come in with technical intervention. We have a culture which is rich and beautiful and is as... You know, and as clearly defined by its language as Italian is from English, we don't want to be forced to become hearing people. That's the political position of a growing movement in the US. Now, and that's a position which is also echoed by a couple of the panelists. And I think we've lost Graham as well. We have. Okay. Well, while we try and get Graham back, see, this demonstrates, doesn't it, the dilemmas of hearing. This whole program, because we keep losing. Losing auditory contact with others. Samantha, in a way, you're under attack here, aren't you?
Yes.
By definition. And how do you feel about it? Are you angered by what you hear or simply puzzled?
I'm simply puzzled. You can't argue because everyone has a different level of hearing, so you just got to accept the way you are and do as much as you can for yourself.
Mm. Do you feel, Carol Lee, that people who make the decision in favour of technical intervention are traitors?
Oh, no, I just think if people, when they're older, they make their own choices depending on what they want. It's up to them. That's why, again, I must say, you need to give both English language and sign language. That way people have choices. Samantha's right. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I mean, I don't think people have... People have the right to do what's right for them, but what I have a problem with is that hearing people who know nothing make decisions on behalf of very young children or making judgments about what is good about the world and what's bad about the world. Mm. And you're quite right, Philip, when you say the hearing world isn't just English, it is music, it is birds singing and the things that you went through, that's quite right. But the deaf world isn't just sign language, the deaf world is, as Sophie mentioned, it's visual.
Tactile.
I mean, I see so much, probably more than what you do. So we're on par, really. Your hearing perspective, it's always a hearing perspective, will never change because hearing people understand the world in a hearing way. I accept that. But why not accept us as deaf people and have our perspective on the world and let's stop the argument?
I don't have a problem. I don't really have an argument. Mm. I'm sitting here as gatekeeper, but I think we've got Graham back. Graham, the proposition is that, in a way, what you're doing or what you're participating in is a sort of a violation, rather like little kids being circumcised. How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel personal empathy with deaf people because my father had a hearing loss when I was a kid, so I know what it's like to live in a family with a hearing problem. I do respect the rights of deaf people, and I do have a lot of empathy with them, and I think we're really talking about treating people as a whole, not just focusing in on this is a, shall we say, a deafness problem. But I would like to say that as far as our work with children with implants is concerned, we have 95% of our children come from parents who have normal hearing. And we're giving them options to have hearing in the same way as with a hearing aid, you might say, except in this case, the bionic ear is now for children who don't get useful help with a hearing aid, but it's really very little different from offering a parent an option to have hearing and to enter the hearing world. That's really what we're aiming to do. I'm personally empathetic to the children who would like, or parents who'd like their children to sign.
This is Classic LNL on ABC Radio National, and we've gone back to an award-winning program from 1993 where a cast of thousands discuss and sign about deafness and the idea of a distinct deaf culture.
I was reading one of the 20 accounts in modern medical literature of people who'd been blind for most of their life regaining sight. And far from this being a triumph, an unalloyed joy, in almost every documented case, someone who'd been blind for 40 years or 50 years found getting their sight back a disaster. And very odd things happened. They would turn off the lights at night so they could go back to being blind, so they could walk around the house in the darkness, because gaining sight meant losing blindness. It's a point I made earlier. So I'm still fascinated by the total disparity between the two cultures. What are you grinning at over there, Carolee? This is a very serious discussion. So I'm interested in the gulf between the cultures and what is lost with intervention. Carolee, can you tell us some of the things, apart from language, that you believe that are exclusive to deafness, that are a part of a deaf culture which we cannot share?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to explain to a hearing person. For me, I can say I can see a beautiful world. You can answer, well, I can see a beautiful world too. But because I can't hear, the visual world is more sort of, it's more attuned. I mean, I get visual hints and, I mean, movements in the air. It's very different. It's more reliant on what we see, and body language and facial
touch
expression.
And sensuality? No?
Maybe. But also in facial expression and body language.
Mm.
It's very difficult for you to say to a deaf person when you feel really well, when you're not, because the deaf person will spot you for a liar. I mean, they'll know as soon as they look at you,
terrific.
You're not well. Oh, well, good on you. You do look terrific too.
Oh, you lie beautifully. Now, Sophia, here's someone else who... here's someone who lives in two worlds. You're a visual person, as you say. You've got to work as an actor. Theatre has two main forces or main modes of communication. There is the visual mode and there is, the mode of language and of sound. Tell me what theatre is like for you.
Right. Well, because acting is my profession, I've made the choice to push my way mostly into a hearing world, because at the moment in Australia there's only Theatre of the Deaf for deaf actors. And I have an option of working with Theatre of the Deaf for the rest of my natural life, which I don't want to do because I'll become extremely stale and crabby. or another option is to make my own theatre, my own visual theatre with other people, or to perform on the same level as other actors within this country who are not deaf or hearing impaired. And because of that, I've had to develop my skill in speaking and really watching the people around me when I'm on stage. I can perform in any play. I've performed in Shakespeare, I've performed classics, I've done all that.
How do you know when it's your turn to talk?
I have very quick eyes. They burn rubber when I'm on stage. I also learn other people's lines. I try to learn the entire play so I know other people's lines, and usually during the course of rehearsal, without actually consciously doing it, I take note of the timing of other actors. I know when they start.
Their body language tells you, yeah.
Body language, absolutely. So I know exactly what's going on at any given point in the play, so I know when to come on and I know when not to do things and so on.
Mm.
Of course, I make mistakes like any other actor, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm equal to any actor in this country in terms of performance.
It's interesting that you have vocal modulation, that you do in fact use your voice very skillfully.
Well, that can be attributed to my vocal training at NADA, only to that. I had speech therapy all my life, but prior to going to NADA, my voice was definitely not as good as it is now because of that.
Okay, well, let's go back to Graham now and find out what the technology, this much maligned technology, actually delivers at the moment and what it might deliver in the future. Graham, what is an effect on offer to a parent or a child faced with the problem, the opportunity of deafness and the dilemma of choice?
If they would like to choose to have their child enter the world of sound and communicate by auditory, oral or similar means, that is, and the choice is to firstly see that they don't need to have a hearing aid, and there's a lot of research we're doing with a cooperative research centre to improve hearing aids and make them, shall we say, more intelligent. If they're not suitable for that, we then can offer them the choice of a bionic ear if they, for medical reasons, are suitable. The bionic ear for children is showing that they can get, we call it open set recognition, that is, ability to understand speech without a significant amount of speech without the need to lip read in about 60% of the children, and the remaining children get help with lip reading and also hearing environmental sound. So the results are similar to those that we're getting with adults who've had hearing before going deaf, and that's been an encouragement to us. The other thing that we've discovered is, and it's not unreasonable, that the younger you operate on a child, the better the results, because the brain is very plastic in those early years of their life. And I think there is some pre-wiring of it to handle the speech signals, so that we do find that the children's results when they're operated on younger are better. And I guess the third thing that's been really, from our point of view, good news for those who want to take that option, and that is that the results are, we are showing no plateauing. We're finding that the children are getting better and better results. So the ones we've operated on earlier are now performing as we'd have hoped, and doing better and better each year. So this is recent data, so that I'm not saying that all children are suitable, but a large number of parents do want to have this option.
Graham, what other sounds come with the package? Is it possible to hear some of those other mellifluous sounds that I was mentioning before?
Yes. Well, actually, I was intrigued hearing what the participants were saying. And going from the poetry to the science, there is data to show that if you are deaf, your visual perceptions do increase, so that there is supportive evidence for that. But what I'd like to do is just, may I quote one of our patients who was a signing lad, and this is written by his mother and him, and can you bear with me just for a
minute? Yes, of course. We've only got a very few moments left, Grant.
He said when he had his implant switched on, he was surprised the engine became louder with the pressure on the foot on the accelerator. He laughed when he realized that the rhythmic noise was the blinkers. He heard the birds, the dishes being washed in a nearby flat, and even the refrigerator. They're not mellifluous noises, but he got excitement in the world of sound. But he finishes, and I think this is very important, he finishes by saying, or his mother says, he enjoys the freedom of communication with his deaf friends in sign language and speaking with his deaf and hearing friends. He appreciates being able to hear and is very thankful for his bionic ear. Now, I think that bridges the gap. Here is a lad who not only can enjoy some signing, but he can also enter the world of sound, and so he's increased his options.
Graham Clark, I thank you for that. We're going to go back to Seattle. I understand that Harlan is still there. Harlan, do you have a final comment just before I thank everybody and wrap the program?
Well, I'd be very uneasy if we left the hearing parents in your audience with the impression that the cochlear implant would, in fact, provide significant understanding of speech in their children. That's a very rare occurrence. I have to disagree with Professor Clark. The published literature shows that most deaf children, 9 out of 10, who...
But Harlan, leave the technology aside.
Well, it doesn't work. That must be relevant.
If it does and when it does, does your position change then?
Well, no. I think you've covered very well the ethical dilemma that if you can make a minority child a majority child, should you do it?
Mm.
But I think that what counts most with the parents who only see deaf children, hearing parents in a disability mode, what counts most for them is, can you fix it? And I am dismayed at the excess of professional zeal, which has led surgeons and audiologists to say, yes, we can largely fix it.
Okay.
Which is what I heard Professor Clark saying, and the figures he cited are out of the ballpark. I mean, they're just not like what's the results of scientific studies.
Harlan, I thank you for your contribution. I thank Graham Clark as well, but I'd now like to give the last seconds of the program to the deaf people surrounding
me.
And Sophia, you are very anxious to say something.
Sometimes I think that the nuts and bolts of how much you can hear and how much you can't hear is pretty much irrelevant. Whether people want to use sign language, whether they want to speak, or whether they want to have a cochlear implant, of course, is entirely up to personal choice or up to the parent's choice of what they want their deaf child to be. What I think the most important thing is that deaf people have access to education. And I think that's the most important thing any human being can have. And studies have shown, I will put my 2 cents worth, that deaf children access most easily to education in a language that is natural to them, and that has proven to be sign language. And that would be my only case for saying why I think a deaf child should learn sign language, because it is the most natural, easy language to learn for a deaf person. It is tailor-made for their visual acuity. And education should be easy to access. And that would be my last word on that point.
You can't hear this, but Johann Sebastian Bach is now swelling in the background, so none of you can say anything else, only me. And I just have time to thank Carolee Aquiline, Sophia Gollan, Samantha Green, and the wonderful Paula Weber, who has been a trooper and a Trojan over there. The fingers are flying. Thank you also Harlan Lane, Bruce Shepherd, and Graham Clark.
Thanks, Gladys, for your company in another week of LNL, ending with that enlightening conversation about deaf culture, originally broadcast in 1993 when we were all young and full of promise. We'll see you on Monday, but stick around now for the news on ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/ rn/podcast.